Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the VGI Partners Asian Investments Limited FY20 results briefing. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session. If you wish to ask a question via the phones, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. If you wish to ask a question via the webcast, please click on the Ask a Question tab on the top right corner of your screen anytime during the conference. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Robert Luciano, Portfolio Manager, VGI Partners. Please go ahead.
Good morning, and welcome to the full year 2020 results conference call and webcast for VGI Partners Asian Investments Limited, or VG8. I'm joined in the room by Adam Philippe, the VGI Partners Chief Operating Officer, and Ingrid Groer, who heads up our investor relations team. From our investment team, we have Robert Poiner in New York and Andrew Chow in Tokyo. David Simons and Tom Davies are with me in the room in Sydney. Thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your support and interest in VGI. The primary purpose of today's call is to give you an opportunity to ask any questions you have for me and the team here. Before we open the lines, I will provide an update on the portfolio and how we are positioned, 9 months on from the VG8 IPO. First, post-tax NTA per share as at 30th of June was just shy of 2.50 dollars, which was the IPO price. While we didn't get everything right by a long shot, the VG8 portfolio was basically break even and outperformed each of the major Asian indices for the period from listing through to June 30. Just to give you some context and comparison, the TOPIX index of Japan, which is the key Japanese equity index, the Hang Seng of Hong Kong were down around 8% both for the period. In addition, the Straits Times index of Singapore fell 20%. The slides that explain how the portfolio is positioned today start at slide 9 of the pack and were lodged with the ASX this morning. Now, you can see here on slide 9 that as at the 31st of July, VG8 had long equity exposure of 52% and no short exposure. By mid-August, this had increased to 55% long exposure. Since listing, we have taken a careful approach to investing the VG8 capital, slowly building holdings in companies on our target list that are trading with an appropriate margin of safety. While there will always be investors who would like to see us deploy capital more quickly, we've been consistent with our investment philosophy and focus on capital preservation. This was discussed in the prospectus. When fully invested, we expect VG8 will typically have net market exposure of 75%-100%. Turning now to the short portfolio, and as I noted a moment ago, VG8 currently has no short exposure. Those of you who were on the VG1 call earlier this week would have heard me discuss the challenges of shorting in the current environment. The combination of fiscal and monetary stimulus, together with the market's current preparedness to ignore accounting issues while looking through near-term earnings weakness and even medium-term earnings weakness, all play a part. Therefore, while opportunistic short selling of businesses, which we consider to be of low quality and/or materially overvalued, will generally be a component of the VG8 strategy, you should expect us to take a cautious approach to shorting until there's a change in the macro environment or we see substantial catalysts evolve. In the meantime, we think the best short is holding cash. Also, on the left of this slide, I note that we have hedged VG8's currency exposure such that investors are now 100% exposed to the Australian dollar, and this has been the case since late July. We've had some questions about what this means, so I should be clear that when we reference currency exposure, we are talking about the portfolio as a whole on a look-through basis. This means that at present, we hold VG8's cash in Australian dollars, and we have also hedged our foreign currency equity investments. And this leaves the portfolio exposed to the share price movements of its investments, but not the currency movements. You might recall that after the IPO, VG8 had 100% exposure to the US dollar, and then moved to a 50% hedge position in June. Changing VG8's strategic currency position came after several months in which the performance of the Australian dollar was highly correlated with global equity indices. In addition, and at the same time, changes in the macro environment mean that we are now far less confident that the Australian dollar is fundamentally overvalued than we previously thought. So, in these circumstances, we would prefer to generate returns from fundamental company analysis and stock picking without exposing VG8 investors, who generally speaking are focused on Australian dollar returns, to currency movements. Now, on the right-hand side of the slide, we've set out a reminder of the countries that we are focused on for the VG8 portfolio. We've always said that to be considered for inclusion in the VG8 portfolio, a company must be listed in a country with a robust and reliable legal system, strong corporate governance, and developed capital markets. In practice, this means the portfolio generally will be weighted towards investments in countries such as Japan, South Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Australia, alongside companies listed elsewhere with significant Asian market exposure. Nothing has changed on this front, but we have made one adjustment to our selection screens for the portfolio, and that relates to Chinese businesses with international listings of VIE, or variable interest entity, structures. Until recently, we've not been prepared to look at VIE structures due to our conservative approach. However, this was an error, and there are some very high quality Chinese businesses that meet our criteria for investment that are listed in Hong Kong and the USA, but accessible only through VIEs. We think there's a place in the portfolio for these companies. However, we will take extra care in how we manage the portfolio weightings and be extremely cautious with US listings given recent developments, which was actually part of our original concerns. Before we get to the detail of some of the positions in the current portfolio, we've set out here on slide 10 a reminder of what we look for in a company that we're considering for inclusion in the VG8 portfolio. It's exactly the same approach we take when investing for our global strategy. Generally speaking, we're only interested in investing in a business with a business model that is relatively easy to understand and operates in industries with an attractive industry structure. This means our focus is typically on concentrated industry structures or firms that own highly recognisable brands or have other attributes that drive economic profit growth, such as network effects. Of course, we are focused on the quality of management and having a team on the ground in Tokyo with strong Asian language skills and cultural understanding very much helps us do our work on this front. And that team is headed up by Andrew Chow in Tokyo, and he is supported by a team there that consists of Kanta, Brian, and Kyoko. Now turning now to slide 11. We set out here the top 10 portfolio holdings as at 31 July. We haven't shared this level of detail before, but as I will discuss shortly, we'll be doing so monthly from here on in. However, this disclosure will be on the condition that we do not prejudice our investment operations whatsoever. I'm very happy with the quality of the VGA portfolio and how it's coming together. And I'm very happy with our cash holding at the moment. Looking down the list, there's heavy representation from companies listed in Japan. But other than the Japanese Stock Exchange, these are all businesses with either Pan-Asian or global growth. As we build out the portfolio, we'll be including more companies that have the potential to deliver high growth for a longer period. One that's in this category is a leading video games business that entered the top 10 earlier this month. We're also likely to increase VGH's exposure to the highest quality medical technology businesses in Asia. Outside of the top 10, but in line with my earlier comments and VIEs, VGA has also made a small investment and now has modest holdings in Alibaba and Tencent. And these are two of the best technology businesses in China. One other portfolio change is that we've exited MTR Corporation earlier this month. MTR is Hong Kong's monopoly operator of rail assets and also the owner of adjacent retail, residential and commercial property assets and has a very substantial land bank in Hong Kong. Nonetheless, we believe there are better opportunities elsewhere. Turning now to slide 12, and I'll make a quick comment on capital management before talking about the important investor communications initiatives that are discussed on this page. We've had a number of shareholders ask questions about whether VGA would be undertaking a buyback, particularly after the VG1 announcement earlier this week. Capital management was on the agenda when the board met yesterday. It's a matter for the independent directors. The discount to NTA is something we all take very seriously, and the independent directors recognise there are circumstances where a buyback would make compelling sense. The magnitude of any discount to NTA is one issue that should be considered. However, the independent directors did not think it was in the best interest of all shareholders as a whole to announce a buyback at this time. One of the factors they considered was that the VGA portfolio has been listed for less than 12 months. In fact, circa 9 months. And we're all still deploying the VGA portfolio. They thought that VGI Partners as manager should be given a reasonable opportunity, given we cited a 3 to 5 year investment time horizon in the prospectus, to manage the full quantum of the capital raised under the IPO and in accordance with the strategy, and to demonstrate the efficacy of the strategy to investors before taking any action that would reduce the size and liquidity of the listed entity for the long term. So, they have told us that they want to see VGI Partners working harder to educate advisors and investors in relation to VG8, which is what this slide is about. The initiatives set out here replicate the program we are putting in place for VG1 and VG8 as part of our program to address the discount. We've been told by investors that they want more insight into portfolio composition and our decision-making processes. And we are committed to doing everything we can to get this right. Our investor relations team is currently overhauling our monthly reporting so that from September, we will identify our top 10 long positions, except when disclosure would compromise our investment operations, and also include more discussion of these portfolio positions and the contributors to performance each month. We will also be hosting more webcasts to provide portfolio updates, at least one a quarter, as well as regular videos with our senior analysts, such as Andrew Chow, Tom Davies, Mark-Ian Slemmy, and Rob Poyner, discussing key stock positions. This year, the annual October Roadshow will be held virtually. We've started planning for this, and we hope that all of you on the line will join one of the town hall meetings, or perhaps more. We will release the detail of these sessions in the coming weeks. Outside of this, we're always happy to get on the phone or do a Zoom call to take any of your questions and talk through the VG8 strategy. And that is exactly the same for VG1, because we know many of you are shareholders in both. Just please get in contact with Ingrid Grower from our investor relations team, and we will get the right people onto the line to speak to you. So that brings us to the end of the presentation, and we'll now move to questions. Rachel, we will start off by taking questions that have been submitted over the webcast before we go to the phones. And I've asked Adam Philippe here to read out the questions from the webcast. Adam, it's over to you. Thanks.
Thanks, Rob. We've got a couple of questions coming through already on the webcast. How are you seeing valuations in Asian markets, especially the VG8 holdings versus the rest of the world for similar businesses?
Yeah, okay, that's a good question. In some parts, the valuations are still quite attractive. It depends by industry and it depends by sector. It's interesting because during the sell-off, the Asian sell-off seemed to happen first and then rallied back much quicker. Why? Because China was recovering faster. So a key driver of some of the businesses that we're involved in, a number of them are Japanese listed, is growth coming from the Asian region, particularly from China. Some of those equity prices came back very quickly and are reflecting positive news out of China and a positive consumer in China. Then, if you have a look at some of the technology valuations, some of these Chinese online valuations or Chinese technology companies, the valuations have moved in line with global markets. So it's on a case-by-case basis, but in many instances, the revaluation effect happened very quickly in Asia. It's one of the reasons why we were able to buy some more positions during the sell-off, and you'll notice we got more invested during the sell-off. But as per our global portfolio, we were far more cautious perhaps than others. On the fundamentals have been quite concerned about the outlook really for the next number of years, and thought that yes, the stimulus would add to the buoyancy in markets or perhaps add to exuberance in markets, but not nowhere near to the extent that has played out. And so we were rather cautious with our acquisitions. Did we wish that we bought some of the securities at lower levels compared to where they are now? Yes. And hence why we have cash, because some prices in a variety of markets have moved to levels where we would rather be sellers than buyers. But to answer the question, the valuations differ by region, they differ by sector. But still in the US there's some attractive opportunities, or in Europe, and the same in Asia. Some of the situations in Japan still remain attractive, and it's one of the reasons that we've probably been building some positions in Japan. I think Japan as a whole is still overlooked or largely dismissed by international investors. And I would say access to growth in the China market, if you consider and have a look, for Australian investors are trying to access China growth through a variety of Australian companies. And I think the penny has dropped that, A, you're paying a very high price for these valuations in Australian listed companies, and B, there's now a question mark over the ability of these Australian companies to extract growth out of China given what is happening in geopolitical land. Australian companies arguably have a lot of issues doing business in China over the short to medium and possibly longer term. Whereas a number of Asian companies, particularly Japanese companies, seem to have very good prospects. The Chinese government's very happy with the Japanese government. It's gone out of its way to reach out to the Japanese government in recent weeks to ensure that Japan and China remain have close economic ties. And so the ability to access growth in China at attractive valuations, not only out of Japanese companies, but some other companies within the Asian region, is there and very present, and we think in some cases very poorly understood and in many cases not well researched. So we see opportunities, but we are hoping that the prices that the market has sort of factored in at these levels, we are hoping that some volatility is going to give us better entry prices. That's a very long-winded way to answer your question, but it's a good question.
Thanks, Rob. Another question here. Help me understand, excuse me, as to why 9 months on, the fund is still sitting on 45% cash. Could some of that cash be better deployed to increase existing best investment idea positions?
Well, first of all, we have a maximum cap at cost of what we can put into existing positions. Some of the, you know, we're close in some cases. We have been adding to positions. We have got new positions. But the reality is, you know, imagine we had a variety of companies we wanted to get invested in, and we got fully invested in the first few months, and then we're down. The reality is we had a portfolio. We bought securities at prices we thought were attractive. As some of you may recall, going into the end of last year and early this year, the trade war effect between the US and China was heating up. There were a variety of geopolitical issues, and valuations were high, and we were very cautiously positioned. As it turns out, the fund was very well positioned going into the March period. You only need to look at the NTA in March to see that the NTA of the fund went up quite substantially, and that was because we were positioned in US dollars. Now, we made a mistake to not cut that US dollar position, and we are all obviously very, you know, it's been a huge error, and I'm obviously very disappointed with myself. And I'm extraordinarily frustrated, and I'm sure all investors are frustrated. But we were very well positioned with the portfolio, and we did add substantially during that sell-off. As you can see from the weekly notices, we were adding. We added substantially to our key positions and bought new positions. We bought a variety of luxury goods positions in Europe. We built up our position, which was in Louis Vuitton and Hermes. Those positions we then made approximately 50% on, and we have transitioned into Richemont, which is a growing position and we think is extremely cheap. We are not going to keep building the current positions because, unlike the global portfolio, we have more of a restriction on the position sizing, and that was in the prospectus. We have some capacity to add, and we would like to keep that capacity in case there is volatility and perhaps the market, global markets, do continue to go up every day forever, but perhaps they don't. And we would like to be prepared with some cash to execute. We've found some new positions lately which we've added and are now substantial holdings. One is Olympus, which is the leading player in endoscopes, leading global player in endoscopes. It actually has a 70% market share. You might think of it as a digital camera business. It still has that. It's loss-making, but it's actually divesting it, which is terrific news if you're an Olympus shareholder. and that's a position that we've substantially grown. More recently, we've built a very substantial position in one of the leading players in gaming, and we think is substantially misunderstood and attractively priced and have already extracted a good return on, which is Nintendo, and that is one of the larger positions now in the portfolio. So we have been adding to the portfolio. We have been building positions. We've recently built a position in a leading player in the Asian region in spirits. So we continue to find new ideas and new positions, but what we don't want to do is pay a full price or overpay just to get the capital invested to appease some investors. That's never how we've operated in our 12 years. We've always invested capital as we see the opportunities, and we've always been perhaps too cautious. And perhaps that has handicapped our returns over time, but what it has done is it's ensured that we have generated a 10 to 15% return net through the cycle since inception in our core fund, despite being conservative, despite holding too much cash, and despite making a number of errors. And we believe that our strategy will pay off over the medium term with our Asian fund. And again, I should highlight the key Asian indices for the period that the VGA portfolio was active were substantially negative. And despite our errors on the currency, and despite our errors on some shorting, where we made money but then gave up those profits and lost money, we managed to break even through the period, despite Asian markets showing negative returns. So, we are neither pleased nor satisfied with that outcome, but we have preserved investors' capital during what has been quite a difficult period. And now you'll see that the NTA is back to the issue price, and we'll see how the portfolio goes over the next 12 months. And I look forward to reporting back on portfolio positions each month, and certainly on our next investor call.
Great, thanks, Rob. Next question here. Can you please describe a typical approach you take to investment in a company? For example, analysis of value versus growth, talking to management, visits, etc. Views around the makeup of the management team, for example, ownership, invested management, cash flow assessment, etc.
Okay, all right. Well, look, that's a terrific question, and that's a very detailed answer. I've already given some very long answers. That's maybe something that our investor relations team can get back to you on. If we're a construction company, you're going to say, well, how do you build a house? There's not a simple answer to that. It's reasonably complex. And again, maybe that's something we could do a video session on, but that's an involved answer. So thank you very much for your question, but we will get back to you on that. And that gives us a great idea to do a video on, and maybe Tom Davies or Andrew Chow or a number of the team can take people through how we go about an investment.
Thanks, Rob. Your thoughts on Crown Resorts now included in the portfolio, please.
Well, we got to buy Crown Resorts during the panic at what we thought was a price that was below replacement cost. My only regret is we didn't buy enough of it, and its result came out yesterday. It was very good, better than expected. I'm surprised by people's ability to look through so many headwinds. We got very close to buying more not too long ago, but it's underlying. It's a high quality asset, meets a lot of our criteria. It's a duopoly operator, has very valuable licenses. We think has a very good management team, and combined with another very similar business, we have 3.5-4% weight in duopoly Australian resort operators, and we think they're very good very good businesses with a long-term view, particularly when you buy them at distressed prices.
Thanks, Rob. It seems like the market has priced in a low risk-free rate over the long term. In search for yield, equity multiples have increased. Given economic fundamentals are weak, is there room for growth going forward, or should we accept low growth going forward?
Oh, well, if I could answer that, you know, that's what everyone's trying to work out. You've sort of summed it up yourself. Yes, the market is factoring in a very low risk-free rate forever. Why? Because central banks are saying that they're going to be very low for a long period of time. It means growth is scarce, the price of growth is high, hence multiples are high or cap rates are low, and you know, should you expect lower growth going forward? Generally speaking, yes. But are there opportunities that exist in the world? And are there opportunities that exist in Asia? Yes, there are. And that's the, you know, that's the job that we have, and you know, we intend to execute on that. Does it mean it happens in a straight line or each week or each month? No, but we constantly find, you know, finding new opportunities, and the reality is that you know, over the last 9 months we've found a variety of opportunities that have popped up in places that we've been surprised by. I would have never thought you would have got to have bought Crown Casino at the metrics it traded at. The key is to put a huge amount of capital to work in it, but given the fact that I've never thought that a pandemic hadn't factored in a pandemic and the effect of a pandemic on a casino that then shuts for a period of time and then has substantial amounts of government salary support and so on and loan waivers, it's a relatively complex situation, and it hasn't ended. And I think that the assumption of low interest rates is one thing, but the fact that there's no volatility, that perhaps is an erroneous assumption. And so we're in a highly complex environment, and the current market price environment since March really has been underpinned by central bank intervention and government intervention through use of fiscal policy tools and direct injection of cash into consumers' pockets. The sustainability of that is questionable, and the reality is short-term risk-free rates may be low and may be suppressed by central banks, but the question is what happens to the long end of the interest rate curve, and ultimately do we end up in a prolonged period of disinflation, or is there some prospect of inflation? So I think when the consensus is always for one thing, it typically doesn't tend to turn out that way. So we remain vigilant.
Thanks again. I
hope that answers the question.
Another question here. Seth Klarman suggested in his latest investor letter that one structural implication of COVID-19 will be the partial reversal of globalisation. Do you agree? And if so, what, if any, impact does this have on your Asian investment strategy?
Well, not only Seth Klarman has said that, but a variety of people have said that. And I don't think it's a function of COVID-19. I think it's more a function of the policies of the government of the United States of America are creating a substantial change in the geopolitical environment and creating a very substantial reversal of some longer-term policies and trends. Hence the trade war effect, hence our caution at the end of last year of investing your capital in the Asian region. So do I agree? Yes, I agree. COVID has been an accelerator of what was an existing trend that had started with the presidency of President Trump and the realisation by not just the Republicans and President Trump, but also the Democrats, that there is a substantial issue for the United States over the medium to longer term with the rise of China. And so I think that you'll find that this deglobalisation effect is very genuine. It's very real. It's an investment trend that it's a trend that we need to be thoughtful of or think of as investors. And what does it mean? It means that the Asian region has some very powerful tailwinds, and it means that a lot of key manufacturing, key parts of business that were done in China have moved. They've started to move, and they started to move last year. They moved to Vietnam. Some moved back to Japan. They moved to other parts of Asia, Thailand, Indonesia. And so it's a very powerful force. It's also meaning that the Asian region could become its own hub in itself. It means that the Hong Kong Stock Exchange is going to be the epicentre of technology stocks for the Asian region. It means that the Japan Stock Exchange may have an interesting prospect to attract other listings as a result of the US move to ban Chinese or restrict Chinese companies listing on US exchanges. So there are lots of powerful forces. It means something if you're a 5G operator, and who makes your equipment, who makes your military equipment, who makes your medical equipment. There's a lot of very powerful effects here, and yes, it's a very substantial trend, and it's very important to think about as an investor. It's very important to think about as an Australian. 80% of our iron ore goes to China, and they'll keep buying it, is the consensus view. Well, perhaps, but when you reach peak steel intensity as a developed country and you have alternative sources of iron ore, well, I just don't think that you want to make a generalisation or an assumption. We Australia may be made an example of. And that has implications as an Australian investor. And you need to be very careful if you're Australian and you're an investor in an Australian company that's growth avenue is China. It's not working well if you're in Bali, but now if you're in wine, and who knows what comes next. I'm not sure it's going to be that good for universities, Australian universities. And so do I think it's a trend? Yeah, it's a real trend, and it's been happening before COVID, and COVID has accelerated it. And what is taking place now will be the an issue of our lifetime. This breakdown in relations between the United States and the Anglosphere and China is a very substantial consideration as a global investor. And as an Australian, it's a very substantial consideration.
Thanks, Rob. Rachel, can I just check if there's any questions that have come through via the phone?
Thank you. There's no questions on the phone at this stage. Just a reminder, if you do wish to ask a question via the phones, you will need to press the star key followed by the number 1 on your telephone keypad.
Okay. Adam, what other questions are there?
There's a couple just touching on the buyback.
Yeah, and there's one here on, what's this other one from the meeting and travel constraints? What's that one?
It was further down, Adam.
Yep, sorry.
There we go. So given meeting and travel constraints imposed by COVID-19, how has that impacted your idea origination and due diligence process? Well, we have a team in Tokyo, and they have still been able to get substantial access to Japanese and Asian management teams. Bit like everybody, face-to-face meetings are less likely to happen. It's more telephone calls and Zoom meetings, and I think that's now standard really for most people. It hasn't affected access in any way. Face-to-face meetings have dropped, but we don't believe there's been a meaningful impact, and I think this is the realisation by a lot of people now around the world, and hence what you could argue is a structural threat for business travel, is the realisation that a lot can be accomplished via video teleconference and or other forms of communication, which will only evolve given the introduction of 5G technology. And really, some meetings should be done face-to-face or certain tours of facilities perhaps are very important. But the reality is, I think us and I think a lot of other people have realised that you can accomplish a lot through video conferencing. But it doesn't eliminate the need to ultimately get out and meet management face-to-face. And depending on the business they're in, have a look at facilities and so on and so forth. And we're very much keen to get back to doing that.
Thanks, Rob. This question references the question prior. With this change you refer to, what is your view about investment in India?
There's some very interesting opportunities. You can get access to it via a variety of companies outside of India. Just like I think it's terrific to get access to growth in China through Hong Kong or through Japan or through other exchanges. It gets back to the point about, there's regulatory issues, there's legal issues and there's accounting issues and language barriers. There's some interesting growth opportunities. But it is a highly complex place to invest, and there are a lot of hidden risks. I think that's all I'm prepared to say on it at the moment. There's a comment here. Does the portfolio's high cash weighting represent a belief that Asian markets carry a high level of downside risk or difficulty finding mispriced investments? Well, it's neither one nor the other. It's the reality is we could add more to our existing investments that we find attractive, but we have a limit at cost as per the prospectus, roughly about 8%, and a number of those positions we've built up to at or around at cost, close to 7%, 6.5-7%. And we've got a number of positions that we're slowly building, but we would like better prices. Maybe we're being too cautious on prices. And it's not a lack of opportunity. We've got a sufficient number of investments in the portfolio that we could grow them all. We just think that some prices have moved so quickly. There's so much, in some cases, being factored in, and we just have a degree of caution given what has transpired. And the fact that we don't think we're operating with an underlying sense of clarity in terms of the environment, particularly for the consumer. In many cases, people are still either working from home. There's travel restrictions. There's government injections, and I think it's a we're just not prepared to we're just not prepared to deploy all that capital. But if we find the right opportunity, like I said, we've found a position in Nintendo recently at the right price. We've built a very large position. That position's roughly 6%. And so we found an opportunity. We think it's mispriced. We bought it. We're putting the capital to work. But, have money, must spend, right? That's not our attitude or approach. And I think anyone who has that attitude or approach I'm not sure that we're the kind of investor, we're not that kind of investor. There are other kinds of investors who look for monthly returns and chase quarterly returns, and they're chasing returns in the short term. And we're not chasing short-term returns. We take a 3 to 5 year view. And that's been our approach, and our cautiousness certainly paid off. We didn't take full advantage of it, and I made a mistake with the currency. That was the biggest error, to not lock that in and have the NTA at 275 or 280. It's an error that I made given the view on the world I took at the time, and I made a mistake. But I don't believe it's a mistake to be cautious in this environment. And we're 9 months into it, and we continue to execute, and we continue to build a portfolio, which can include some of the higher quality companies in the Asian region. The biggest holding of this company is Kikkoman. That's a $10 billion market cap for the leading player in condiments, particularly soy sauce, that is seeing a very substantial improvement in its operations, particularly in the United States, as there's a shift from restaurants to at home, where the margin on its wholesale or its restaurant businesses is in the low single digits, but its margin in at home is in the 20% range. It's a business that continues to expand its returns on capital and meets a lot of attractive features, established distribution network, and has very substantial growth opportunities. Number two position is Yakult. It's the leading player in probiotic beverages in the Asian region. It has only just this year finalised its distribution network, sales and distribution network in the United States of America, where it was only previously focused on the west coast of America, particularly San Francisco, where there's a high Japanese population. It's accelerating its product reach in Indonesia, it's selling its product reach in Vietnam, and it's established multiple manufacturing facilities in China and has retained its value share in China during the COVID period because it's viewed as a high quality premium product. Doesn't discount. Olympus, the third largest position, is the number one player in the world in gastrointestinal endoscopes. It has 70% market share. It is going through a dramatic transformation for a Japanese company of liquidating and exiting non-core businesses, highly unusual for a Japanese company, is exiting its core business. What was its core business originally, which was cameras, is exiting that business, and most recently announced the sale and transition of its manufacturing facility in the United States to a third party. Extremely unusual for a Japanese company. It's accepted an outside director and is making very substantial changes to evolve. Nintendo is now the fifth biggest position, and it is one of the leading players in video gaming technology, not just in platforms, but in the manufacture and development of games, and has a catalogue and has characters that it can monetize quite substantially given the shift to mobile gaming and other forms of gaming. And it's substantially overlooked by investors as a brand and as a platform relative to peers. So, you know, I would just sit there and remind everybody that the portfolio has got some very substantial positions. After that, there is Richemont, which is effectively the Cartier and Van Cleef luxury jewellery business, which has substantial growth in the Asian region. In fact, Asia is its biggest part. You know, Tom Davies has done a lot of work on that. But Tom, if you want to have a quick discussion on Richemont and, you know, its growth prospects in Asia, which I don't think people really appreciate.
Yeah, so 45% of sales are attributable to Asia, but we believe that the number is far higher due to tourism. As a result of a reduction in tourism flows from COVID, we think that will be reallocated towards Asia, and we're already starting to see some of that growth come through. Another area to note with Richemont is that they own Yuke's Net-a-Porter. So that's loss-making currently as they replatform the business, but we believe over time that will be a very valuable part of the business and is obviously the leading e-commerce luxury platform globally.
With substantial growth in the Asian region, given its joint venture with
Alibaba.
Right. The next biggest position is the Hong Kong Exchange and Clearing Corporation, which happens to be the largest exchange on the planet and an extraordinary beneficiary of the United States government's administration policy to make it very difficult for Chinese listed companies in the United States of America. As a consequence, they are now moving their listings to a dual listing structure and or primary listing structure at the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. It's also seen very substantial expansion in its Stock Connect program between mainland China and Hong Kong, which is a substantial growth driver, and its results were reported yesterday, and that extreme growth has been reflected in earnings that reported yesterday. So I think we are finding opportunities. I think we are putting the capital to work. We are making substantial progress, but we are cautious and we are focused on capital preservation, and we are being judicious in our approach and our capital allocation. And as I said before, I think at this point in time, given the monetary policy and fiscal policy environment and the central banking involvement of the major central banks, and the distortions that has created, we believe the best short in many instances, particularly for the VGA portfolio, is cash. So I think that's a key point I'd like to make. Is there a final question, or is there...
I think that's probably all we've got time for today.
Okay.
Thank you all once again for your interest in VGA and for joining the call today. If you do have any questions that we didn't address, please contact Ingrid Grower, and we can happily address your questions offline. Thank you. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Thank you. That does conclude the conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.